Welcome to our podcast in conversation with the Lancet Child and Adolescent Health. It's the end of November 2023. I'm Amy Snowgrove, the senior editor for the Lancet Child and Adolescent Health. And in today's conversation, we will be talking about celiac disease in children. Celiac disease has received much media attention in recent years, or perhaps more so with gluten intolerance, gluten sensitivity that are in some way related that we're going to be hearing about. But what it really is and who is at risk and what can be done about it is not always very clear for most people. So I'm really delighted today to be joined by Drs. Marisa Stahl and Yvonne Liu, who are pediatricians and clinical researchers at the Colorado Center for Celiac Disease at Children's Hospital Colorado. Marisa and Ed led a review of celiac disease and what we can learn specifically from prospective cohort studies that has just been published in our journal. So Marisa and Ed, hi, and welcome to our podcast. We're really happy to have you here today.
Hi, thank you so much for having us. It's such an honor to be here.
Yes, hi, thank you for having us here.
Oh, it's my pleasure to get to talk to you today. So before we dive into the sort of scientific conversation about celiac disease in children, I'm always really curious about the people behind the papers that we publish and how they came to focus on their specific area of research. So it would be lovely to hear a little bit more about yourselves, perhaps a bit about how and why you ended up in the field of celiac disease research.
Yeah, I can start. So I always knew I wanted to be a pediatrician, and then in medical school had the opportunity to rotate specifically pediatric gastroenterology and just loved it and knew that that was the field that I wanted to specialize in and be in. And that continued throughout my residency, was just always very interested in taking care of that patient population. But to be completely honest, I did not know a lot about celiac disease until my fellowship here at the Children's Hospital of Colorado, when I was able to meet Ed Liu and work with him, and he was my, and still is, my research mentor and clinical mentor. And really got to take a deep dive into these different celiac disease studies, including the TEDDY study, which we will talk more about today. But, you know, I think celiac disease is such a unique disease process to be able to research and study and to participate in clinical care. It's one of the few autoimmune diseases where we actually know the trigger. And because of that, the research is just so interesting when you think about trying to get a better understanding of the landscape of triggers and then disease prevention. And so it's really, really unique because of that.
That's really interesting, Marisa. And you're absolutely right. It was fascinating to me while I was reading this paper. I mean, as you say, so many autoimmune diseases, we don't really know what is causing them, what can be done to prevent them, whereas actually there's really a lot understood already, as we're going to hear more about as we go through this conversation. And Ed, how about you?
I started off in research actually in the field of type 1 diabetes. I had a mentor, George Eisenbarth at the Barbara Davis Center for Diabetes, who was really an expert in the epidemiology and autoantibodies for type 1 diabetes. And we looked at ways to try to prevent disease using vaccines of insulin peptide. And from there, I naturally migrated, because I'm a gastroenterologist, to the study of celiac disease. You know, and back then there really weren't any, you know, animal models for celiac disease. So we started to look at patients instead. And that's how I got involved in the TEDDY study, which is cited in this article, along with the DAISY study and other kind of long-term studies like that.
That's super great. Thanks so much. Okay, so let's dive in a bit now into the science that we're here to talk about, and maybe just starting off a bit with some basics so that we're all clear on what is celiac disease, how does it relate to gluten sensitivity, and it would be great if you could just clarify a bit these terms and perhaps how children and adults differ in relation to celiac disease.
Yeah, absolutely, Amy. You are so right. These have really become somewhat household terms over the past decade. And in some ways, that has been great because it's created a lot more awareness about these different diseases. But I think also in some ways has created a lot more confusion about what these different entities are. So celiac disease is an autoimmune response to gluten. And gluten is a storage protein that's found in wheat, barley, rye, and some other grains. Gluten is presented and absorbed in the small intestine, which is why much of the diagnostic process of celiac disease focuses on intestinal inflammation that can be observed. However, I think it's really, really important to remember that, like other autoimmune diseases, celiac disease can really impact every system of the body, and symptoms are not just limited to the gastrointestinal tract. Based on some older studies here in the United States, the safety threshold for gluten intake for people with celiac disease is less than 20 parts per million, which really means that for the most sensitive of individuals with celiac disease, they might have symptoms even with just a crumb of cross contact from gluten. And this is really different from other disease processes in this spectrum that we talk about. So things like IgE-mediated wheat allergy, which is an IgE-mediated food allergy to wheat, so a different trigger than specifically gluten, and it can lead to anaphylaxis when people eat wheat and they have a wheat allergy. And, you know, when people have celiac disease, symptoms when they do have gluten exposures can vary really markedly among individuals, everything from abdominal pain to vomiting to diarrhea to headaches, brain fog, rashes. It's very different for each individual. And overall, this process of celiac disease is different than non-celiac gluten sensitivity, which is the other term that you will hear tossed around. A really important point about non-celiac gluten sensitivity is that the diagnosis of this, can only really be made when celiac disease has been adequately ruled out. So when people have had the adequate screening for celiac disease and that is negative. And this can actually be really challenging for providers, particularly when individuals are already on a gluten-free diet. So I would say for the general practitioner who's dealing with a child or an adult where they're concerned about symptoms with gluten, it's really, really important to counsel patients that even though they may not feel well when they're eating gluten, it's important to stay on gluten for this diagnostic process to really help sort out whether it is celiac disease or non-celiac gluten sensitivity.
That's great. That's really helpful. That's really helpful and really helped, yeah, to understand the differences between those two. In your paper, the review that we'll be publishing in our January 2024 issue, you chose specifically to focus on evidence from longitudinal birth cohort studies. And perhaps you can just explain for us a little bit why. What was the importance of that? Why does the study design really matter in interpreting the evidence in relation to celiac disease and understanding what the underlying risks and triggers are?
Yes, absolutely. But Amy, just taking one step back, because for this particular review study, we did focus on pediatric studies. And so I do want to talk just a little bit about the difference between, adult and pediatric celiac disease and subsequently studies and why we focused on pediatric studies. The diagnostic process that I talked about is actually very similar in children and adults. So I'll let Ed speak a little bit more to the differences between adult and pediatric celiac disease.
Sure, thanks. I think, first of all, when we think about the terms gluten sensitivity and gluten intolerance, those are sort of like broad, like imprecise terms, right? And it's better to think about this, like think about celiac disease as an autoimmune disease. And there's other things like wheat allergy, right? Which usually occurs in young children that they cannot grow. But then the other term that's now being used is non-celiac gluten sensitivity, right? And this is defined, it's actually really poorly defined, but it's defined basically as you react to gluten and you get symptoms, yet you know you don't have celiac disease. So I think a lot of people probably fit in that category, but the problem is there's a lot of people who are gluten sensitive who've never been tested. So they sort of fall into the unknown section. We don't know if they have celiac disease or a non-celiac gluten sensitivity. Now in terms of like looking at adults versus kids, we did focus on kids, but it's important to recognize that both children and adults can get celiac disease, right? And it's also important to recognize that no one's born with celiac disease. It develops over time. You have the right genes, you eat gluten, there's some sort of breakdown tolerance. And the children and adults can have the classic symptoms of celiac disease with the usual GI manifestations. But a lot of them can also have symptoms that occur outside the GI tract, like extraintestinal manifestations, or they can even be relatively asymptomatic. And yet they can still have full-blown disease. Now, the reason why we study kids is because kids are particularly vulnerable to celiac disease. And it might be because their immune system's really pliable, right? And there's potentially many new environmental exposures for them that can really influence the immune system one way or another. And so it seems from our studies, it seems that once you're past a certain age, though, your risk of developing celiac disease really decreases. So when people develop celiac disease, it happens pretty quickly within the first 10 years of life. And that's why it's important to study pediatrics for the environmental triggers. Okay. Of course, this is research looking at kids, and we don't really know what the potential triggers would be in adults. But I do think that many adults who are diagnosed with celiac disease have probably had it since they were children.
That's great. Thanks very much for clarifying that. That's really helpful because I think that, yeah, it's something that definitely people are confused about. Super. So if we take it on today, so, I mean, that was obviously one of the values of looking at these birth cohorts where children were enrolled or moms were enrolled in pregnancy, essentially, in a lot of the studies you focused on. And maybe you can just take us a bit more through that and the benefits of that approach.
Yeah. And then I think the other piece of this is the longitudinal aspect. So not just studying infants, but following them over time to see if and when they develop autoimmunity. And so I think with celiac disease, we have really come to an understanding that it can have a very heterogeneous clinical presentation, meaning that some children can present with many, many symptoms. And some children can be completely asymptomatic. And what we really wanted to focus on for this review was what is known about the genetic and environmental risk factors for celiac disease autoimmunity and celiac disease development. And in order to really know about those risk factors, you need to know exactly when children develop autoimmunity with respect to these different exposures. So really the optimal study to look at these risk factors follows these observed genetic and environmental risk factors in infants from birth, or, you know, we don't have as much data on this in celiac disease, but I think it's probably going to be important in the future to follow even before birth to get more information on potential exposures during pregnancy. And then prospectively follows these infants over time with very frequent periodic screening for celiac disease antibodies so that we know the exact age that they develop celiac disease autoimmunity. And I'm kind of tossing these terms around lightly, but celiac disease autoimmunity means that we see that these children have positive antibodies or blood tests for celiac disease. And that is not necessarily the same as celiac disease, which has very, very specific diagnostic clinical criteria. So the IDEAL study, looking at genetic and environmental risk factors, has that periodic antibody screening, but then also has a protocol for confirming whether it is truly celiac disease as well.
These longitudinal birth cohort studies are important because, again, we talked about why it's important to look at children in terms of risk factors. And we know that disease develops really quickly throughout childhood. So that's why it's important to study kids in particular. And these longitudinal cohort studies allow you to track children before disease onset, right? And you can continue to follow them up to the earliest time point of when disease actually begins and then beyond. And so you can compare children who develop disease to children who you might say are resilient, who don't develop disease. You can start to develop associations with specific genes and environmental triggers, looking at those who develop disease and those who don't. So, you know, I think with these studies that we look at, the one caution is that we're looking at associations and not causality. And so findings from these longitudinal cohort studies can highlight the risk factors, but they really can't establish causality, and they can't really yield much on disease mechanism.
That's great. That's really helpful. And so from these studies, what sort of comes out at the end of the day as really being kind of the key messages about what we know so far in terms of risk factors?
Yeah, so while these studies have greatly contributed to the knowledge about genetic and environmental risk factors for celiac disease, none has identified one single risk factor alone for celiac disease development. There isn't really quite that smoking gun yet. And I think it's really important to understand that there are multiple factors that contribute in one individual for celiac disease development. And right now, while we have learned a lot from these studies, there's not really enough evidence to suggest, for instance, changing infant feeding practices to prevent celiac disease development. From these studies, really exciting advances have been made in how the quantity of gluten intake early in life, early life infections like rotavirus and enterovirus and microbiome may all contribute to celiac disease development. But we really need more studies and also interventional studies to understand how these entities combine to impact celiac disease risk so that we can provide more clinical guidance in the future as to hopefully how to prevent celiac disease.
Yeah, I'd agree. You know, I think overall in children, it boils down to really having permissive genes and how much gluten you're exposed to, especially in early childhood and early childhood infections. I mean, in the simplistic way, those are the three main factors, but there's so many other factors that can play a role. And how these all interact hasn't really been precisely defined yet. And that's the key, is really understanding how these things interact. And so from what we've learned through all these studies, there's certainly not enough to advise practitioners or parents on how to raise your child to be celiac disease free.
That's great. That's really helpful, because I think so often we are looking for that one single answer, or for moms in pregnancy or with young children to know, well, if I just don't do this, my kiddo is going to be okay. And it just isn't that straightforward yet. But it was really helpful. Well, I didn't know about the sort of the genetic predisposition and the HLA predisposition, and that actually you can be in a group that no matter what you do, you won't ever or very unlikely to be able to develop celiac disease was interesting. And then also the rotavirus piece was very interesting for me. And with rotavirus vaccination expanding, how much we will see that maybe changing the epidemiology of celiac disease or not. Yeah, with the combination of risk factors, it'll be interesting to watch.
Absolutely. It will be interesting to see how that impacts. And then I think also how the changing kind of viral landscape in childhood will impact celiac disease development. You know, I don't think we really know the full impacts of the COVID pandemic, for instance, but clearly there is a relationship between early life infections and specifically early life viral infections and later celiac disease development.
Great, great. And so, I mean, with particularly Ed, maybe, and Marisa, but with your kind of long-term experience and kind of watching, being part of where this field has evolved over the last years, it would just be really interesting to see how the thinking, or hear from you, has the thinking changed, how the thinking is changing in understanding celiac disease?
I'll let Ed go first on this one. He has more gray hair.
Taking care of patients for like 20 years. But, you know, I think what we've seen over these years is that, at least in Colorado, it's certainly much more accepted in the community. You know, there's certainly a better understanding of what celiac disease is. And nearly everyone knows someone with celiac disease these days, whether it's someone in the family, friends, classmates. And so maybe the interesting thing that's changing in the field is that there's actually drugs being studied for this condition. Right. So there's a lot of drugs in the pipeline. Right now, there is no other treatment for celiac disease other than the strict lifelong gluten-free diet. And these drugs that are being looked at could be potentially used as an adjunct to gluten-free diet. But there's some that are being used to possibly even replace the gluten-free diet. And so this really does make it an exciting time to be involved in the research community for celiac disease.
And with my much shorter term perspective, what I can say is, you know, in medical school, when I learned about celiac disease, it was really about children who presented with failure to thrive and malabsorption, who are very, very sick. In fact, in celiac crisis, sometimes when they would come in and present initially. And I think now we have a much better understanding of the clinical presentation of celiac disease in children and adolescents. And we're understanding that really a majority of pediatric patients are identified with non-classic symptoms, things like fatigue, headaches, rash, joint pain. And many are completely asymptomatic. And so I kind of think, you know, with that understanding, as clinical providers, we really need to maintain a low threshold for screening, as diagnosis and treatment can really help improve these non-classic symptoms and help prevent complications.
And I mean, it's just making me think, so I'm in South Africa and all my clinical work has been here. And I mean, we still see so much what is sort of thought to just be classic severe acute malnutrition, you know, the old edematous kwashiorkor. And yeah, I mean, I think so many of those kids could fit this picture. And I think that's a setting that generally, I think in Africa, it's a setting that we are not really thinking about this as much yet and not exploring it. And very often it's just put down to whatever the common cause is and not looked at further. Yeah.
That's a great point. You know, it's... And I think in every community and every background, you're going to have folks with the right genes that are permissive for celiac disease. And so we're not always thinking about this. And this is sort of why we wonder whether or not doing mass screening, you know, of the general population would be the right thing to do, because, you know, probably about nearly a half of the population with celiac disease actually are subclinical or don't have any symptoms. Yet we think that they're probably still at risk of these long-term complications.
Right. Oh, so we could have a whole nother conversation about that one day, about the screening. Yeah, that's very interesting. And so where do you see this sort of field of research heading? What do you think are the exciting things that are developing and advances that are being made to accelerate our understanding of this?
You know, I think the field's really headed towards, you know, first of all, drugs, right? Medications for the treatment of celiac disease. And as we start to get these medications for the treatment or management of celiac disease, I think it's very reasonable to start thinking about prevention and public health, right? Like, how can we use our knowledge of how disease develops and what factors that are associated with disease onset and who's at high risk? How can we use this knowledge to try to prevent or intercept disease before children actually get sick with celiac disease? And so going back to these longitudinal cohort studies, you know, there's a lot of biologic samples that are collected both pre-disease and at disease onset. And knowing what to measure and putting that biologic data together with our epidemiologic understanding is really going to be critical in helping us design future disease prevention trials. So the future really is, I think, in terms of disease prevention.
And piggybacking off of that, I think a big part of the future of medicine is personalized medicine. And I think these newer methods like machine learning and multi-omics will hopefully help us combine the knowledge that we have regarding these different risk factors for celiac disease and really help us develop personalized approaches to prevention and to treatment.
That's great. So exciting. We're definitely going to be watching this space. So we're about to wrap up, but before we end, is there anything that you would really like to be sure that clinicians or researchers or policymakers sort of that come across this topic know about in terms of prevention or support for children already living with celiac disease?
So we touched on this earlier, and it really could be a whole separate podcast, but you know, we can only help improve celiac disease care and prevent celiac disease if we screen for it. And we really do feel like there's a compelling case because of that for mass screening to help aid in earlier detection and eventually prevention. And some countries like Italy have even already created national initiatives to this. And I know that this was also not the focus of our particular podcast, but is really critically important for celiac disease care, because right now the only treatment that we have for celiac disease is a strict gluten-free diet. And because of that, having support from experts in nutrition and mental health is really crucial for all of our patients with celiac disease. And, you know, there are some countries where policy helps support that and other countries where policy does not help support that.
So important, so important. Thanks, Marisa. And any last thoughts from you, Ed?
Sure. You know, I mean, you don't have to include this, but, you know, I'd like to just finish by saying that, you know, celiac disease is common, right? It's one of the most common autoimmune diseases in childhood. It's not rare. And I do think that we might be in the midst of a childhood epidemic of celiac disease. And remember that these kids are going to grow up to become adults with celiac disease. So there's going to be more and more individuals with this. And we don't know why this is happening. We're trying to understand the cause. But it's almost enough to be considered a public health problem when we talk about policy, right? Whether or not someone's symptomatic or not. And so as we gather more supportive data, now, developing policy or guidelines really on how to screen the general population might not be so far-fetched. And like many of these longitudinal cohort studies in this review, you know, combining screening with other autoimmune diseases like type 1 diabetes might be the best approach when we're thinking about testing the population. And there's a number of reasons why doing these kinds of things together may be best.
Great. Well, I think we're definitely going to have to line up another conversation in a couple more years to see where this has gone. And certainly the idea of and seeing the evolution and where things go with the screening is going to be very exciting, as well as the treatment. So Marisa and Ed, thank you. This has been really valuable and a delight to talk with you today. Really exciting to hear where this field is going. And we'll certainly continue to watch this space. And thank you to everybody listening. The review by Dr. Stahl and colleagues on celiac disease, What Can We Learn from Prospective Studies About Disease Risk, is now available at thelancet.com. And whatever your role is in child and adolescent health, as Ed has highlighted for us, this is not uncommon. There are many children living with celiac disease or at risk of celiac disease. So I'd really encourage you to take a look at their review. It's highly informative, a very accessible read, and with a great visual summarizing what is known and unknown about celiac disease risk in children. And remember that you can subscribe to In Conversation with the Lancet Child and Adolescent Health wherever you usually get your podcasts. And bye for now.